Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
After we finish recording our episode, the next day I binge watch the rest of the People versus O.J. Simpson.
It's that one was good too, like the dramatization of it. So well done. I don't usually like what Ryan Murphy does, but this time I did.
I'll have to say, having been through an hour-long talk about the trial and then watching that, there was a lot of yelling at the television from me.
Yeah.
Lots of, this is a mistrial. This is a mistrial.
Yeah, it's like willing it to be different.
Yes.
But it never will be.
Yes, willing it to be different. Willing the outcome to be something new. But I thought it was very well done. And I definitely learned a couple things that I didn't know, like, about like the personal lives of the people involved. So I thought,
oh yeah,
you know, how do you make something like the OJ trial even juicier?
Get Cuba Gooding Jr. and John Travolta and David Schwimmer, Selma Blair, just get them all in there and
when fucking
cause a fuss.
Yeah, when fucking Schwimmer, who plays Robert Kardashian, fucking starts to doubt OJ, I was like,
yeah.
Oh my god.
He's kind of like, the word I use to like that comes to mind is like sniveling for him in that show.
Yes.
He's just kind of like on the edge of the like the group, not really sure what to believe, but like is gonna do what's status quo. He just seemed like a little like brown noser.
Well, it took him a long time to grow his spine and figure out where his loyalties lay. But it was really fun to see the kids who were playing the baby Kardashians.
Yeah, that's fun. There was a like a bit in the ESPN documentary where apparently OJ like had the TV on with his agent and Kim Kardashian came on like to promote Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And he was like, that's my goddaughter. That show is stupid. Like... it'll never take off. And look at them now.
Yeah. You're dead and they're billionaires.
Yep, pretty much.
In olden days, a glimpse of FEMA was only for morbid dreamers. But you're not alone. Bring anything bones. Two goofy gals with deathly interest go on a skeleton inquest in your headphones. Anything.
Hello and welcome to Anything Bones. I'm Sophie Mummies Schwartz.
Oh my god. And I'm Caitlin in the dark heart. And this is the podcast where we talk about things that are known to some and unknown to others.
I thought I would give Caitlin, since she did that marathon of an episode last week, she covered the OJ trial and crime all in one fell swoop. I thought that I would see your trial of the century and raise you the find of a century.
The find of the century. Have they found Cleopatra yet? Every day I'm like, is she... what is that lady's name that's going to find her?
Dr. Martinez? She is
on
close.
It.
She's... Caitlin, she is so close. That was almost what this is about. You're very close because she is getting extremely close. She was given like special dispensation to search the water around. I don't know if you remember, but there's like tunnels
into the sea.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she was given like... license to like search that area for like 2 weeks. So we are going to be able to see the results of that soon. And this is an extremely exciting time for archaeology vis-a-vis finding Cleopatra's tomb.
Yeah, come on.
Dr. Martinez, we all believe in you.
Yeah, right? It's like, come on. This is not just your dream anymore. It's our dream
for
you.
It's our dream, Dr. Martinez. We are behind you.
Uh-huh.
And we are wanting this for you very badly.
Mm-hmm.
And today that will come up a bunch, wanting to find something quite badly.
Okay.
Today we are going to be talking about the finding of the tomb of Tutankhamun.
Oh.
We're doing okay. I've not covered it.
Is that King Tut?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I was like, why do I know that name?
King Tut, the iconic quintessential mummy, what some might call the face of Egyptology in a way, the face of Egyptomania in the early 1900s, one of Western archaeology's biggest and most profound finds. And I've always said to myself, I would love to do a show on Tutankhamun, but it would be so much. I couldn't cover it in half an hour.
And then.
And then.
We switched up the format for 2 weeks.
Hey, it's our show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We do what we want.
The second you want to pay us is the second you get any input. So Tutankhamun and his tomb and a little bit about his mummy are what we're going to talk about. I will say up top, and I'll say it again later, I reserve the right to do an entire show about his mummy.
Okay, sure. We'll produce that along with my series on the OJ trial and crime and everything. So we can get into all the nitty gritties.
Oh my God, yeah. If we just took those two topics and just were like, every week I will dive deeper and deeper.
Into madness.
Into madness. Joe was at work and someone was trying to tell him, he was talking about it with someone, and someone was trying to tell him, they were like, oh, it was OJ's son.
That is like a conspiracy theory that they briefly mentioned on the podcast that I used for my source. Like, there was some speculation about, like, not Nicole's son, but
the older son.
OJ's son from the previous marriage. That is a theory, but
why?
I don't know. Yeah, like there was something, I think I'm reaching back. I think the son was also a waiter, and like when the family decided to go eat at Mezzaluna on the night of the murder, like he was so upset that he killed his stepmom. Like it, yeah, that
I
was
don't
like,
think so.
It doesn't make sense. I didn't really look into it that much because like, they found OJ's DNA there.
Yeah, and familial DNA is close, but it's not the same. Unless,
right.
Like, do twins have the same DNA?
I don't think so.
Yeah, they have to be slightly different.
Let me see. I don't want to sound ignorant, but I don't know.
I don't know either. We'll both sound ignorant.
Okay. Identical twins have 100% of their genes, including those that influence risk for alcoholism. I don't know where the study came from, in common, whereas fraternal twins share 50% of the genes that vary in the population. Okay, so identical twins do share DNA, fraternal twins, not exactly.
Nice. Well,
it's like a normal sibling.
Well, how about we say twin fact instead of dinosaur fact?
Sure, I'm all for it. We all learned something today.
We did. All right, let's do sources and fucking hop into this absolute monster of a topic.
Hell yeah.
All right, Wikipedia 1, 2, 3, 4 times. JSTOR twice. Smithsonian Magazine, Griffith, like the Griffith Collection, which is a collection of photographs that I'll show you later.
Okay.
Yeah, 2 from there as well. Let's hop in. The Tomb of Tutankhamun was discovered in the Valley of the Kings in 1922. And this discovery is almost 3,000 years after Tutankhamun was buried.
Damn, he was hidden, hidden.
Hidden, hidden. And we'll talk about a little bit how he got so hidden. Because that's always my question. It's like, you've got a building, right? That like stands on the surface of the world. And then time passes and somehow that building either deteriorates or it's buried or like somehow these things are lost and then we're able to find them again. And that's so fascinating to me.
It's wild. And it's, yeah, it's just like you kind of never know what you're stepping on, you know?
Yes. Oh, my God.
That's what I think about sometimes.
Alternative name for the podcast. You never know what you're stepping on.
It's kind of a mouthful, but I'm into it.
Well, in the parentheses in the bottom, it's bones. Or as Darren used to say about the TV show Bones, why are there so many skeletons in DC?
Yeah, because There were a lot. They traveled a little bit in that show, but there was a large concentration of murders and bones in DC.
Some were in Virginia.
True.
Well, I'll tell you who's not in Virginia.
King Tut.
Yes, exactly. So the tomb of Tutankhamun is also known by its tomb number, which is KV62. And Tutankhamun was said to have reigned as pharaoh between 1334 and 1325 BC.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I can't even fathom that. How long ago that was. I'm sorry. Continue.
Well, I mean, just as a reminder to everybody, the period we think of as ancient Egypt itself was thousands of years. So, mm-hmm. The amount of history that's packed into this time period that's all kind of lumped together in the Western thought pattern is dense. She dense.
Lots of pharaohs.
Exactly.
Lots of war, probably.
Exactly. And, you know, there was a bit of turmoil with Tutankhamun kind of taking the throne because he did take the throne when he was 9.
Oh, that sucks for everybody.
It does suck for everybody. He did have advisors and things like that.
God, I hope so.
Oh yeah. He did marry his half-sister, though.
See... It was a different time.
It was done differently
That's
then.
That's so gross now, but it's I don't know. It was probably something about keeping the bloodline intact or some shit.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the big moves that Tutankhamun made as a pharaoh was to change the religious structure of Egypt at the time. Because they had gone from their kind of polytheistic, what we would think of as the multi-gods, Ra and Osiris and all those other gods. They had moved from that into something called Atenism, which worshipped a different god. But Tutankhamun was no, we're going back to the old gods. Everybody wrap it up. We're going back to the old stuff. And everyone was awesome, yay!
Yeah, I mean, if you have your whole life with multiple gods for different things, and then suddenly it's no, that's not it. That would be hard to stomach.
Yeah, and it had been the other way for a minute, but I think a lot of, I was not there, but sure. I think there were people who were happy to see the return of the older religion.
I do just think it's wild that kings and pharaohs and monarchs can just... At various points in history have been you know what? I think everybody should be a different religion. Go on, do it. Change everything about your belief system because I say so.
And if we find you Catholics, we'll burn you.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just what arrogance is this? It's just so weird.
I mean, we could have this conversation for days.
Of course, yeah.
But one could say...
It's unanswerable.
Yeah.
Whatever. It's just so stupid.
But the core of that is the power is a little unimaginable to be now you believe something else.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the person in charge is actually, never mind. We're going to go back to the way you like it. That would be dope.
I mean, that would be great. I'd be relieved. So when you're a young pharaoh, of course, you get going on your tomb.
Sure.
First thing. And your mortuary temple. Because, of course. Gotta have both.
Is that where they embalm you and stuff?
I don't know if it's done there or if that's just the place where you can make offerings to their kind of patron gods and them in particular in the afterlife. But interesting question. So unfortunately, before his tomb could be completed, Tutankhamun passed away.
Okay. Do we know why?
Well, the cause of his death is actually a hotly debated issue, or it was for a while. In 2012, it was suggested by testing that he died from a combination of malaria and a leg fracture.
Okay.
Although, inbreeding also probably made him a little bit more susceptible to disease and having maybe some brittle bones.
Yeah, totally could be. And like really bad breaks and fractures and stuff. Can't that cause like ulcers and stuff?
Yeah. And
infections.
Yes. His bone was necrotizing.
Oh, God.
So
yeah.
That was not that, good.
That so that comes up at my work sometimes. Because there's a podiatrist within my department.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people have these wounds that like go down to the bone where like they just have to have surgery because it's that bad.
Oh, my God.
I try not to think about it too much, but it comes up quite a bit.
Wow.
You can't. Yeah. It's just.
Yeah.
It's really astounding.
We'll
take care of your vasculature, people.
Yes. God, your veins? Very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't talk veins very often on the show.
No. I try to keep it. I like to keep my workplace separate from my podcast place.
Even though technically they are the same place sometimes.
Right now I'm sitting at my home desk. So yeah. Been here all day. Thanks.
Well, let me liven things up. Some people thought perhaps Tutankhamun could have been murdered.
Oh, no.
But they disproved that.
Yeah. Sounds like they were wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, once you're able to access things like x-rays and CT scans, you're really able to get a way better idea of what happened to somebody's body than in like the 1920s, yeah, where you're like, ooh, part of the head is broken.
It's a much better story, though, that, to you know, to for him to have been murdered.
Especially by like maybe like a jealous vizier or something.
Sure, sure.
So now that we have a bit of background on Tutankhamun and what he was about and how he passed away, we're getting to the tomb. Tomb talk, as I have named this segment.
Get to the good stuff.
Yes, exactly. So as I told you, his tomb had been started but not completed by the time that he had passed away. So,
oh, shit.
Yeah, that's a big oh shit moment, because in Egyptian culture at the time, we needed to be burying people 70 days after their death. So like quite a period, but not enough to finish a royal tomb.
Yeah, not enough time to build a pyramid without modern technology.
Exactly. And we weren't really in the pyramid time. This is a great point. We weren't really in the pyramid time at this time. We were talking about an underground tomb.
Gotcha. The opposite of an upward pyramid.
a downward pyramid, one might say.
A V, if you will.
A V, if you will. Well, the shape of the tomb I'll show you in a little bit.
Okay.
But so they looked around. They said, all right, who's got a tomb we can take? And so they took a non-royal tomb and they expanded it. They were like, we'll take this, you know, good tomb, but not like king level tomb. And we'll make it king level for him.
Okay.
After his death, one of his advisors, A-Y is how it's spelled, became pharaoh. And this is because Tutankhamun actually did have two children, but they were both stillborn.
Oh.
I know. But his advisor actually is the one who ended up getting buried the tomb originally meant for Tutankhamun.
You know, it all works out in the end.
Yeah. You know, things ain't so bad. So the tomb that Tutankhamun ends up getting consists of four chambers and an entrance, staircase, and corridor. It's a lot smaller than other Egyptian royal tombs of the same period, but, you know, he doesn't know that.
They did it on the fly. They did their best.
They did do their best. Of course, King Tut was buried with many funerary items, which we will talk about in more detail later when we unearth them again.
Okay.
So within a few years of Tutankhamun's burial, his tomb was actually robbed twice.
Fuckers.
I know.
Don't you have any respect?
Can't you leave this dead teen alone?
That is very tempting, though, because it's like he's not actually using it, like maybe in the afterlife, but the physical item is just sitting there. So I get that would be tempting, but it's bad.
But can you imagine if things that were robbed from your tomb disappeared from your actual afterlife? Like if like Ooh. Someone came in and robbed a chair from your tomb and you go to sit and now the chair is gone.
Well, I mean, they are stealing from a king or a pharaoh. So it's like, you know, maybe that was part of it. I don't know. It just I wouldn't fuck with a tomb myself. I'm not trying to get into a tomb ever.
No, if I'm in a tomb, I'm there on a sanctioned tour. So these robberies, the first one, people ended up seeing the evidence of it, and priests went back in and like kind of put all the rubble back in and resealed things up and were like, okay, we've put back some of the damaged grave goods as well, and they've made it right. And they reinforced like the door and stuff. And then the second people to rob the tomb just like burrowed in the side of the corridor.
God damn it.
I know. The second time that it was robbed, it was also resealed. So from this point on, the desert grows and shifts and moves as the desert do. And this area is also subject to lots of flash floods.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And so the water's not really a problem. It's the sediment it leaves behind, because that's what ends up burying this tomb, along with 150 years later, a tomb is getting built pretty close to Tutankhamun's tomb, like right next to it. Nobody important, just Ramses V and VI.
Oh, yeah, no big deal.
NBD. They're building these tombs, right? And so they got to dig like down to the bedrock. So we're digging out rock and sand and more sediment, and we're putting that near Tutankhamun's tomb.
Sure. Yeah, it's just getting deeper and deeper underground.
Exactly. Plus, you know, there's got to be workers who work on these tombs, right? And they don't want to, you know, fucking commute every day. That sucks. So they are set up a little camp, like huts and stuff, next to the work site. And there's, you know, to them, it looks like nothing. It's been covered by sediment and sand for 150 years. So they're just build their huts and shit right on top of that tomb.
Sure. Yeah, why not?
So now we've got an entire little village on top of the tomb, along with refuse from a different tomb. And so, like, these are the steps that seem mundane, but that bury this kind of history. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, layers of history literally in the ground.
And he gets buried and he gets forgotten. Until...
Dun, dun, dun!
Dun, dun, dun! Let us get to some of the most important players in this story, other than Tutankhamun himself. Let's talk about archaeologists.
Okay.
Our most important boy, Howard Carter. He is born in 1874, and he was a British archaeologist and Egyptologist. He is the youngest of 8 surviving children, and his father had a super cool job. He painted animal portraits for a living.
Yeah. I found my new career path.
Do you want to paint horses and dogs for rich people?
Probably.
Now is your time.
Now that I know it's what they want.
Enroll in Papa Carter's School of Pet Portraits. People legit do that for a living still, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Now that I think about it.
But it's funny that it was a job then, too.
Yeah, some things never change.
Yeah.
Cute.
So, through his dad, Carter met an Egyptologist named Percy Newberry.
Now, that sounds like a guy that is an archaeologist.
Yes, especially an English archaeologist from the early 1900s.
Yes.
Percy Newberry hates sand in his feet, but he loves pulling treasures out of the earth.
Howard Carter just doesn't have the same ring to it.
No, but...
Howard Carter carries the tools in a bag.
Howard Carter made lunch. So Peter Newberry agrees to take on Howard Carter when he's only 17 to bring him to Egypt to help record some of the artwork that they were finding in these tombs and pyramids and other, you know, archaeological sites. Because Howard, like his dad, had shown great artistic promise.
Okay,
so cool. He was able to do like reproductions of these works that they were finding in tombs and other archaeological sites. Carter also started to become super interested in the archaeology itself, and he was really hoping to start getting into doing excavations of his own. And in the early 1900s, he took on a series of jobs with the Egyptian's Antiquities Service, and he was, one of his positions was Chief Inspector of Antiquities in Lower Egypt, and with that, he also had responsibility for the Great Pyramids. So he was responsible for the pyramids. But
casual.
Very casual. He was just like, these are my duty.
This is my responsibility right over here.
Look at those big pointy things. That's my fucking job. He did lose that job.
Oh. Didn't guard them well enough?
Well, he advised some Egyptian guards to defend themselves against a group of drunken French tourists who tried to get to the pyramids after hours.
Okay.
And I think it got violent.
So, like, they should have just let them go in there?
I mean, no. But, you know, if I'm the, like, head of antiquities or whatever, I'm like, oh, yeah, beat up those French tourists. But
yeah,
that was not my job. The pyramids were not my job.
Maybe they were just like, there can't be any trouble at the pyramids.
Right.
We can't have it.
Well, because of the trouble at the pyramids, he lost this job and ended up living in Cairo selling watercolors to tourists. So a low point for Carter. Yeah,
sure. To go from, yeah, someone in charge of pyramids to painting watercolors.
Exactly. And during this time, Western archaeologists are plundering the fuck out of the Valley of Kings. They're just out there digging stuff up left and right, and they're coming back to Cairo, and they're saying to Howard as he's selling his watercolors, they're like, Howard, look at all the cool shit we found in the ground. And he's like, yeah, guys, that looks really cool. And they're like, oh, Howard, we wish you could find some cool shit in the ground, but you can't.
Why don't you paint us a picture of it, Howard? It'll last longer, Howard.
Oh, my goodness. It's like you were there. Were you?
Yes, I am timeless.
You are timeless.
Well, thank you.
So one of the people that was a big player at this time was a retired American lawyer named Theodore Davis, who was very rich, but was not a big fan of scientific procedures.
Great.
He was like, scientific method? I don't know her.
See, why not? Why not? It's science. Like, just please, please.
But this guy did end up funding a lot of excavation in the Valley of Kings, and he was credited with unearthing about 10 different tombs. So
I wonder what motivated him.
I think, I don't know, maybe he liked finding cool shit in the ground.
I guess, yeah.
Because it was a hot time for that.
Yeah.
So Carter is looking at all these guys with their finds, and he's like, there's more out there still. I think that there's more out there still. And Tutankhamun was like very little known at this time. No one was really looking for his shit, and no one really knew who he was. I think they knew he existed because of some artifacts that bore his name, but no one was like, I will find this tomb.
Sure.
Until Carter started to fixate on it. So, like I was saying, there had been, near the entrance of another tomb, several items that bore Tutankhamun's name on them. And so Carter was like, I think that it's time to get together a team to investigate this. He's like, I'm getting back in the game.
Okay.
Watercolors, fuck them.
Yeah, throw those away. Actually, no, I might come back to it. Keep them for later, but I'm gonna go treasure hunting, basically.
Treasure hunting. Our friend, the retired lawyer, Theodore Davis, is close to death in 1914. And Carter is like, this is my fucking chance. Because not only did Theodore Davis help fund a lot of these excavations. He also like owned the rights to excavate in these areas. So you couldn't do digs without his approval.
Okay. So he had a monopoly on artifacts, basically.
Exactly. And he was about to let that go.
Oh, my God.
And so Carter is like, you know what? I am going to team up with a rich English aristocrat named George Herbert, who is the Earl of Carvanon, and I am going to do this dig. But before they could, World War One.
Oh, sure. That old thing always comes up.
That old chestnut.
Hello, this is Michelle, the host of Haunted Moonlight, a Podmoth Network podcast. If you are like me and enjoy anything and everything spooky, then this podcast is for you. New episodes drop every Sunday and are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Audible, and iHeartRadio. Can't wait to keep it spooky with you.
So, during the war, Carnarvon fucked off back to England, and he was like, my house will become a war hospital, which was nice of him. But Carter spends the years of the war working for the British government as a diplomatic courier and translator. And he ends up resuming his excavation work in Egypt towards the end of 1917. They pick their spot where they're going to excavate near where they've found these other artifacts with his name on it. And in these days, I would like you to picture the Valley of the Kings like a giant quarry. People have been excavating in this spot for like years and years and years, and they don't really clean up after themselves. They just go, this pile of rock goes over there. Now I say, fuck you to the pile of rock, and I do not clean it up. And so the next guy who wants to excavate, say, under the pile of rock, they gotta move it.
Yeah, so it's just kind of a mess.
Oh, it's a big mess. So Carter had no choice but to try to clear tens of thousands of tons of this like rock and sand and sediment waste to try to get a clean slate to start his excavation.
Damn. Sorry, guy. You chose a bad time to come out of retirement, I guess.
So he really wanted this. To remove all of this waste, he borrowed a railway track from the Antiquities Service with trucks that were pushed along the rails by hand.
I'm sorry. They're laying track and then like pulling carts in to like, oh, I see, to like load the dirt in and then move it back out.
Yeah.
Without any horses or ox or anything.
No, and no engine or anything. We're pushing
Jesus.
These with local Egyptian men and boys just
Jesus.
Doing backbreaking labor for months.
Damn.
Thousands of times a day, they would take these big baskets that they were just filling with rubble and dump them into these trucks, and then they'd all have to go push them out somewhere else.
Sure.
Towards the end of the first season of excavation, they're able to clear all of the rock debris. And the laborers are able to uncover the remains of an ancient workman's village filled with huts.
Oh,
does yeah. that sound familiar to you?
For the building of the tomb next door, where
yes.
maybe all the artifacts are coming from, or some of the artifacts.
Oh, Caitlin, you're a very smart gal. So they realize that these, like, by looking at the layers of debris and sediment and stuff, they realize that no one had discovered these huts since, like, the second millennium BCE. So, like, we're on the right track. Nobody's been in this area for thousands and thousands of years. So they're basically thinking to themselves, this is the perfect place to look. But Carter doesn't go for it right away.
After they cleared all the shit away?
They're clearing it away from like the whole valley. So like he's basically got a clean slate of this valley to work in. And
okay. He
says to himself that he is not going to go for this like really obvious spot right away. Instead, what he does is methodically goes through the rest of the valley for like five more seasons, excavating not a lot, and is really more interested in doing methodical archaeology than like finding something big right now, which I think is really interesting because he's like, I've got the funding, so I'm going to do all the boring archaeology. And then when my patron is starting to think I'm a total fucking hack, I'm going to bring out the big guns.
That's a strange choice, but, you know, okay.
It really is. And by fucking 1922, Carnarvon, the guy, the rich earl who's funding all of this, he's like, I don't want to do this anymore. All you're finding is a bunch of alabaster vases and a couple ritual deposits. That's not going to fly for a flashy earl like me.
Sure.
And so he actually invites Carter up to his fancy estate in England to like break up with him.
Sure. We need to see other archaeologists.
Exactly. And Carter's like, that's interesting. Because I haven't told you about these huts yet.
Oh.
And Carnarvon's like, what about the huts? And he's like, the huts is where I think it's at. And he's like, okay, fine.
Why didn't we look by the huts to begin with?
The world may never know. I don't know why he didn't immediately blast those huts sky high and get that those fucking yummy artifacts.
I don't know. That's weird.
You know, because that's how they do it. But so there also was an interesting another clue that came up in this time that was these like debris filled jars that they found in the same area as all those other artifacts with Tutankhamun's name on them. They were examined by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and one of their archaeologists was like, hey, I think I actually know what this is. This is all the like trash and like excess supplies and everything that touched Tutankhamun's body, because they don't throw out anything that's touched a king's body.
Sure.
So they're like, this is the stuff used to embalm King Tut.
Damn.
This is the trash from that. Yes.
So it's we're close.
You know how we love archaeological trash. It's always a sign you're in the right direction. If you find somebody's trash, you're like, I'm on them. And in true crime, too.
That's, yeah, sometimes it's helpful to go in the trash.
Sometimes it's helpful to go in the trash.
Oh, there's a lot of DNA in there.
Watch your trash, criminals.
Watch out, yeah.
It's October of 1922, and Carnarvon's like, buddy, you got one more fucking season to find me some fucking shit.
Yeah.
And Carter is like, I'm going back to the valley.
Again.
It's hut time, baby.
I guess. Finally.
So Carter starts his excavations on November 1st, 1922. Right where he left off in 1918.
Sure. Whatever.
Why did he wait? Who knows? But he spends the next couple of days, he uncovers more huts and he starts like clearing them away because he's like, y'all are interesting on your own, but not what I'm looking for.
Sure.
Don't nobody destroy those huts.
I'll look at those later.
So on Saturday, November 4th, after much digging and toiling, Carter gets to the site. And usually all of his like Egyptian workers and archaeologist buddies who are there are like rowdy. They're hanging out. They're having breakfast. Like they're having coffee and chatting. They are suspiciously quiet today.
Okay.
And he's like, oh, man, was there an accident? Is everyone okay? And one of his lead foremen comes up to him and is like, we found a step.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. A step cut into the bedrock under the huts that they cleared.
Keep going, y'all. Keep fucking going.
Shit is on. Men continue digging, and suddenly we are unearthing an entire stairway down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Towards sunset on Sunday, the next day after Saturday, the men exposed the upper part of a door made from rough stones and covered in plaster. The seals on the door show a jackal, the jackal god Anubis, over 9 bound captives. This is the official seal of the royal necropolis.
Oh, okay. So they're like, okay, we found royalty.
We found royalty. This is no joke, and we are going. Carter breaks through the plaster and removes the stones from the upper right corner of the door. He shines in a little flashlight, and he sees that the passage is filled with, like, stones and rubble. So he recovers the hole, and he's like, fuck, I gotta have Carnarvon for this shit, and he's in England.
So, like, he physically needs him?
Yeah, he needs him there. Do you know how much time and money this fucking Duke has put into...
Oh, Carnarvon is the financier? Yeah. Okay, yeah. He's like, I need more money.
He needs more money, slash this is what they've been waiting for. This is what he's been paid to do. This is what Carnarvon has wanted the whole time, is a big, flashy discovery to say to all of his Duke friends, my archaeologist found this crazy stuff in the ground. Mm-hmm. Is not my status raised?
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, the whole finders keepers thing. No, I'm just kidding. But not really. Like, they can sell it sell it to a museum.
Things were not as concrete rules around what you're supposed to do with artifacts. But they did have certain agreements with, like, antiquities services in Egypt. And we'll go into how they treated those in a minute. So he sends a cable to Carnarvon because we don't have telephones.
Right.
And it is no time for letter. So he sends a cable basically saying, get your ass down here immediately.
Mm-hmm. Bring your checkbook.
Bring your checkbook. Bring your daughter. Let's go. And so the next day, the men are like, we have to cover up what we found. Because if looters and grave robbers see what we have got going on over here, they're not going to do scientific procedure. They're going to take a big old bat and bust this open like a fun little pinata of artifacts.
Well, yeah, and they might not have a problem, like, taking down anybody that gets in their way.
Exactly. So it's like if you suddenly found a bomb full of gold. It's dangerous, but very valuable.
Yeah.
And so for the next couple of weeks, they're waiting for Carnarvon to come, and Carter is hiring a bigger crew for this, because he's like, okay, we've really got something now. So the bare bones crew of, like, my buddies and this, like, group of, like, Egyptian foremen are not going to cut it today. And so he hires a guy named Arthur Candler, who is a friend and retired railway engineer, and he ends up being his kind of, like, right-hand guy through the whole thing. Carnarvon and his daughter arrive in Luxor on November 22nd. By the 24th, the workmen have reached the doorway and they are about to get to the official seals again. So after they break through the initial plaster, they get to a next door. And on this door, there were seal impressions showing a basket, scarab beetles, and a sun disc. And this is the cartouche of Tutankhamun. So this is basically a door with his fucking name on it.
They're like, we know exactly who's in here.
We know who's in here. We know it's the royal necropolis, and we know who's in here. We have never been this close before.
We got him.
We fucking got him. So they empty out that corridor full of rubble. And by the 26th, they are standing in that corridor. And again, they are faced with this door that Carter had removed the stones from and, like, stuck his little head. Or this is the second door. Carter removes a couple of stones from, like, the top corner so that he can look inside and take a candle and, like, stick it in there to see if it, like, takes the candle out immediately to see if the air is poisonous. I'm not exactly sure how that works, but
sure.
They're trying to see if it's safe to breathe in there. They're satisfied by their little experiment. And so they widen the hole and they look inside this tomb And they are the first people to look inside this tomb in 3,300 years.
Damn.
Can you even fucking imagine?
That would be crazy.
It would be so crazy. I would like to read to you a quote from Carter's journal about this moment.
Hell yeah.
Quote, "It was some time before one could see. The hot air escaping caused the candle to flicker, but as soon as one's eyes became accustomed to the glimmer of the light, the interior of the chamber gradually loomed before one, with its strange, wonderful medley of extraordinary and beautiful objects heaped upon one another."
Damn. That, yeah, I mean, just to be there and to witness such a life-changing thing, like, I hope that that's the moment for Dr. Martinez.
Me too. I want that for her so badly.
And, like, the world.
And the world. And, like, what we end up learning about Tutankhamun from this tomb, it is astounding. To be able to, like, find grave goods for Cleopatra, to have her sarcophagus, we'll see. We'll see.
We'll fucking see.
We'll see. So while Carter is looking in this hole with a candle, Carnarvon, Mr. Moneybags, is behind him being like, excuse me.
Like, get in there.
Yeah, do you see anything? And that's where he says the famous quote, yes, wonderful things.
Hmm.
And that's sometimes misquoted in his journal. It is recorded as, yes, it is wonderful. But I think they're both, you know.
The sentiment is there in both.
Exactly. They widen the hole in this door, and now everybody is looking in on what is possibly argued to be the greatest archaeological find of all time.
They hadn't found a pharaoh of any kind up until this point.
They had, but this is the most intact Egyptian pharaoh's tomb to be found, I think,
at that point, yeah.
At that point, maybe ever.
Damn, okay.
I would like you to go to the email you've been sent.
I shall.
Did I send it off?
You did, yeah. Okay, I didn't look at it because I've been trained not to. Yeah.
I didn't think you needed it. There's a link there if you would like to go to that link. And that should show you both the black and white and colorized pictures of what the tomb looked like when they first opened it.
Oh my God. That's so cool.
Right? The colorized pictures really trip me out because I've only ever seen the black and white ones, but like to even Caitlin's looking at right now this beautiful antechamber, which is the first chamber that is packed with artifacts. Artifacts are literally packed on top of each other like a Jenga tower.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in here. There's like little animal carvings, like all these boxes. And yeah, this is really cool.
Two ebony black statues of a king with gold staffs, kilts, sandals, gilded couches with the heads of beasts, painted ornamental caskets, dried flowers, alabaster vases, black shrines, white chests, carved chairs, gold throne, heap of curious white egg-shaped boxes, and yes, a bunch of stools. Also, chariot parts.
Hell yeah. Yeah, I saw wheels. That's cool.
Also, the idea that you would reconstruct your chariot in the afterlife. I hope it comes pre-constructed.
I know, like what?
Because if you're a king, you don't know how to construct that
chariot.
Make
the room bigger and put it together.
They couldn't. They were in a rush, remember?
I guess that's true.
So this room, like just this room, is like more and better than anyone had found at the time.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Just this first room.
And this sarcophagus is so beautiful and intricate and like iconic in Egypt and archaeology, Egyptology. You know the name King Tut, even if you don't really know a lot about mummies in Egypt.
Exactly. Like I said kind of at the beginning, he is the quintessential mummy's mummy.
He's the Dracula of mummies.
He is. So from this first antechamber that's absolutely stoofed with artifacts, there are two doorways that had been blocked up with plaster, but they could see they had been broken through by ancient robbers.
Okay, so there were some people in there at some point.
There were, but they were within lifetimes of people who were like involved with the tomb at its beginning.
Okay.
So like, you know, when we're talking about robbers, we're talking about robbers in antiquity.
Yeah, but yeah. How mad can you be? It happened thousands of years ago.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is that they didn't get past like the first kind of level of the tomb. And they didn't. So like the archaeologists, they got in this room, right? And they were like, oh, we found, if we go down this hallway, we found the burial chamber.
Yeah.
And they were like, ooh, we'll peek in a little bit. And they ended up finding the shrine that had the sarcophagus in it. And
yeah,
so
it looks like it had many, many layers.
Yeah. If you also look in the email, there's a diagram of the sarcophagus that they found, because it's like there's the sarcophagus was originally within like a larger wooden structure. And then within that, there's three sarcophagi within each other.
Craziness.
The outermost coffin is made of stone.
And then I think the second one is quartzite. And then I think the third one is gold.
Okay.
The clearing out of these artifacts would require an amount of effort and labor that had never been seen in the archaeological world before.
Sure, because you need a lot of people that know how to handle this old shit.
Exactly. Plus, like, we're talking about moisture from flash floods coming in, and this really damaged a lot of the artifacts. Like the amount of in this tomb, it could go from being super humid from the flash floods to extremely dry and arid. So like we've got warping of wood, we've got glue coming undone, we've got textiles that are fading away, basically. Carter looks at this stuff and he's like, only about a tenth of this stuff will make it back to Cairo without being reinforced and restored. Because as soon as it kind of gets out of that environment, you're in trouble.
Sure.
So at this time, Carter is like, it's time to assemble even more fucking troops.
Apparently, yeah, we got to get this stuff out of there. Although, again, I wouldn't touch any of that.
Oh, no.
Leave it where it is, in my opinion.
Yeah. But he is not going to do that. He is, in a sense, because he ends up using some actually adjoining tombs and archaeological sites as like dark rooms and labs and staging areas.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And he calls up his friends who are chemists, who are experts in translation. He calls up some experts in botanical textiles. He calls up the best archaeological photographer in Egypt, and he rounds all these people up and he says, we've got to do everything here on site.
Yeah, sounds like it should happen immediately because it's a huge find.
Yeah. And in these chambers of the tomb, they're all packed in like that, and some even worse. A quote from Carter says about some of these chambers, quote, so crowded were they that it was a matter of extreme difficulty to move one without running serious risk of damaging others. In some cases, they were so inextricably tangled that in an elaborate series of supports had to be devised to hold one object or group of objects in place while another was removed.
So he was just bringing all kinds of artifacts and shit to the afterlife. They were just like, here, you might need this.
Yeah, they even found like a trunk of his baby stuff.
Aw.
I know.
That's sweet.
I know. I was like, aw, I didn't know that. So upon being removed from the tomb, the objects were cleaned and then, if necessary, treated with preservatives such as celluloid solution and paraffin wax. Because a lot of these artifacts, although they had been down in this sealed chamber for thousands of years, they were covered in dust and dirt and also a weird pink film.
What?
I know. Gross.
Why was it pink?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that's weird.
This find erupted through both the communities in Egypt and in Europe. And Egyptomania had already been going on. Archaeologists were already finding a bunch of stuff, taking mummies back to Europe to unwrap them in fun parties and grind them up for medicine.
Right. And eat them.
And eat them. And do other really weird, twisted, odd white people stuff with them.
Yeah.
They are someone's dead relative. So now a whole other level has come up called Tutomania.
Oh my God. Okay.
People were wild for this shit. And tourists in Luxor were so fucking horny for seeing this tomb that they all went out there and they had to build retaining walls around the archaeological site. And there were so many people that Carter was like, I fear these walls are not strong enough.
Jesus
Christ. He was worried that people would fall into the site from like up above.
That is wild that people would be that like, you know, excitable about a mummy.
I mean, I get pretty excitable about a mummy.
But to like, I don't know, do you need to go there? And I mean, yeah, it's exciting, but yeah, that's, if it gets to like a dangerous place, that's just, whoa.
Yeah, when they find Cleopatra's tomb, I'm not going, but I will be excited. So during the excavation at this time when there were a bunch of tourists there, they would, when they were bringing out artifacts, instead of kind of like covering them and protecting them like they were doing when they were just by themselves, they would kind of bring them out kind of in a presentational way to the oohs and ahs of the crowd.
That's cool.
Which is fun because like archaeologists don't get to be superstars very often.
Yeah, that would be cool. I like that.
Right? That's kind of fun. And then immediately back into like the other archaeological dark areas where they like dip it in wax and like try to like ask nobody to breathe on it.
Right.
By mid-February of 1922, Carter and Carnarvon are going to formally open the burial chamber. As I kind of tried to explain earlier, they wiggled into the burial chamber when they kind of weren't supposed to. They kind of were supposed to wait for like the Egyptian government.
Oh, shit. Okay.
But so now they're formally opening the burial chamber. Formally.
Okay. I see.
On February 16th. And in this opening, they do have government officials in attendance. So at the east end of the burial chamber, there was an open doorway to a fourth chamber, which was called the treasury. And that's where the canopic chest was that contained all of his canopic jars, which were his organs.
Okay.
Isn't that cool?
They were in a separate room beyond the burial chamber?
I believe so.
Damn. This is elaborate.
It's super elaborate. And they let there be like a viewing for like press and the public for about 10 days. And then they closed the tomb on February 26th. Just to give a little check-in, this tomb that we're talking about, Tutankhamun's tomb, is the only royal tomb in the Valley of Kings to be found near intact.
Okay.
So that's what I'm talking about when I say, like, this is the pinnacle for archaeology, both at the time and now.
Yeah.
There were 5,398 items found in the tomb.
Pretty impressive.
Amazing.
All for one guy. And, like, okay, I was, like, saying I wouldn't open this and, like, I wouldn't take anything out of this earlier. But, like, this all hopefully went to, like, museums and it was, you know, done through the proper channels, and hopefully most of them went to museums in Egypt.
Hopefully.
One can only hope, right? I mean, I don't know. I guess we don't know for sure, but
there was a Tutankhamun exhibit at the De Young in San Francisco in 2018. So I think there are a lot of artifacts that are floating around in museums from King Tut. Sure. But I don't know exactly where all of them are, to be honest.
Well, yeah, that's fair. There were 5,000 of them.
There were. One can hope most of them are in Egypt.
I'm going to hope for that. It belongs in a museum, so I hope it's there.
Yeah, exactly. It took Howard Carter 10 years to catalog all the items.
Yeah, I bet it did.
One fun item of interest was a dagger that was taken from the tomb. And when they examined the blade of this dagger, they found this is in later examinations in more modern times.
Sure.
That this dagger was made from meteorite.
Oh, that's cool.
He had a meteorite dagger.
That's sick as hell.
Of course, one of the most impressive parts of this tomb is not the objects, but the tomb itself. If you look, I have some pictures of the inside walls for you.
I saw that. It's amazing. There's like really intricate drawings all on every wall in the burial chamber. Like, it's pretty remarkable.
It is incredibly remarkable. And like we were talking about, the sarcophaguses that he was laid to rest in, that there were three. That's insane.
They don't look that, like, it doesn't look that large, but, it, you know, like, it, I'm just not, why does he need three? I don't know, but it's amazing.
Because he was an important guy.
Yeah.
And speaking of important guys and two important guys meeting, it was not until 1924, 2 years later, that Carter got to see Tutankhamun, the man himself, face to face.
Damn, when like all the wrappings had been taken off and everything?
Yeah, we're going to talk a little mummy talk.
Okay.
And this is where I say that I reserve the right to do an entire show on the mummy. We're just going to briefly go through the mummy. If you're saying to yourself, Sophie, why are you going through this mummy so briefly? There will be more time for the mummy in the future. But we are going to go through a little bit of this mummy. Carter, when talking about this moment, when they opened the sarcophagus, he called it, quote, the supreme and culminating moment.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
So the outer sarcophagus is made of stone. They had to create an intricate pulley system to lift the top of the sarcophagus because it was 2,500 pounds.
And you have to think they did the exact same thing 3,000 years ago to get it in place. And like, what the fuck?
I would love to compare pulley systems.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I would love to see what they used and what the English guys used, you know, 3,000 years later. And I bet it's similar.
Well, you'd have to, yeah, you'd kind of have to use the techniques that they used to get it in there, probably, to get it out.
I mean, you know, if it's not broke. So the outermost sarcophagus is made of stone. And then the second one, I believe, is made of quartz. And the third one is solid gold.
Damn.
Right? So he is covered in shrouds, you know, pieces of fabric cover the mummy entirely. But when you peel those away, you can see the intricate gold face mask.
Ooh.
Which is that iconic, like, face mask. Yes, that last picture. What you think of when you think of Tutankhamun, that, like, shoulders and head full mask, which is made of gold, also lapis lazuli, obsidian, and several other kinds of precious metals and stones. Also on this mask, inscribed on the back, is a chapter 151b of the Book of the Dead. Also immediately below this golden mask, sewn into the shroud, are a pair of gold hands. And these hold the crook and flail, which are the symbols of the pharaoh. The outer wrappings and ornaments of the mummy were incredibly deteriorated, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's been a couple thousand years. Carter also estimates that they may have dumped, like, what would be equivalent of, like, two big buckets full of, like, unguents and, like, oils and resins over him.
Jesus.
So, like, the humidity from that also deteriorated his wrappings. Also, this is so interesting. The unguents, they underwent a chemical reaction, a kind of slow, spontaneous combustion, which carbonized the linen wrappings.
That's, huh. Like they caught on fire, like they burned them or something?
Kind of. Like,
or they poured something weird on them?
They poured a bunch of, like, interesting oils and herbs and resins and stuff over the mummy. And then over time, that like hardened and went through a chemical reaction to turn the like linens and stuff into a more, into like a state where it seems like they had been burnt. Does that make sense?
I think so. It sounds wild. And something you only see in very old shit.
Exactly. And an even bigger problem that this like mixture of stuff that they poured on him presented is that he is stuck inside his mask. Like, he's stuck in there.
Oh,
he's
no.
Sealed in there. And furthermore, he is sealed inside the casket. He is stuck to the bottom of the innermost casket.
Oh, because of, probably because of all the wax and oil and stuff?
Yeah.
Jesus.
And they were like, we can't get him out.
Right.
So they put him in the sun.
Oh my God.
For like a couple of hours where like the temperature out there can reach like almost 150 degrees. So like.
It dried out pretty fast, I guess.
Well, they were hoping to like melt him out of there.
Oh, I see. Did it work?
It did not.
Okay, yeah, that sounds like it would be kind of a long shot.
Yeah. So they end up having to do the examination on site. They can't get him to Cairo or anywhere else. So this is 1924, and they're like, we're going to examine this mummy one way or the other. So fast forward a bit to November 11th, 1925. This is when they're going to do like the unwrapping of the mummy.
Okay.
So we're still at the site with this mummy. No one's been able to get him out. So they're like, we're just going to examine him inside of the casket.
I mean, I guess so. Yeah.
Right. So the external ornaments of the mummy were like removed except for his mask because they couldn't get it off of him. And they found that the outermost layers of the wrappings were also basically like resinized. So what they basically had to do was make a cut from like bottom of mask to ankles and like unwrap it like reading a book, kind of like,
yeah,
like opening it up. And in the first like top layers of bandages, they found about 150 objects.
Whoa. What?
Yeah. Just in there, just like, tucked in there, like little artifacts.
What?
Little ornaments and things like that.
That's crazy.
Little charms. Yeah.
That's, I never knew that they did that. That's so like, that's, it's so detailed.
Yeah. And it's amazing that like, we're able to find these things thousands of years later. Like, it's funny because in this way, there is an afterlife, you know?
Yeah. They get to be seen again.
Yeah, and their stories told again and celebrated. And so they continue to unwrap this mummy. And like the layers underneath, the first layers that we were talking about, have basically turned to dust. So they're getting down to the mummy itself. Again, these resins and unguents had perforated the wrappings and basically glued the body into the coffin. They made the decision that the body had to be, quote unquote, chiseled out.
Jesus.
The torso was cut in half at the hips to remove the pelvis and legs from the coffin. Then okay. The arms were taken out at the shoulders and the elbows and wrists. So they basically took up the arms apart at the joints.
Yep.
To take those out. Then each body part was treated with paraffin wax and hot knives were used to remove the head and neck from the mask and casket.
Jesus.
That's what they had to, that's how stuck he was in there.
That's hardcore.
And this is just the 1925 examination.
Right.
This is one of like five examinations of his body through time. So that's why I'm keeping it here. I'm keeping it at
it
that.
It could just go on and on and on.
This could maybe be another part, 2 hours.
Maybe another part two someday.
They take this poor dead teen apart from his resting place. They chisel him out.
It's a little rough. It's a little rough.
A little rough. They didn't have any ways to, they didn't have any internal scanning other than, geez, I don't even think they had x-ray at the time.
Not portable they x-ray. Might have.
No, not portable x-ray. But you remember those x-rays people had in their homes for a while? Anyway.
I don't know that, actually.
Well, we'll talk about it another time.
Okay.
So, Caitlin, you're itching, you're scratching, you're clawing at the walls. What about the curse?
What about it? Is there
a curse? Don't you want to know? The curse of Tutankhamun, Caitlin?
What is it? That
whoever
you're going
to die.
Whoever opens it is going to die.
Yeah. So, though our dear friend Carter got to have these moving moments with Tutankhamun, Carnarvon was not so lucky.
Oh, no. Cursed.
No. Well, so in 1923, Carnarvon was shaving and he nicked a mosquito bite that he had. And that got infected and he died.
Oh, my God. Damn.
But what was the headline of the newspaper? Quote, Carnarvon's death spreads theories about vengeance.
Vengeance? Of the mummy. Oh, I see.
Of the mummy.
The mummy's like, fuck you for finding me and taking me out.
Exactly.
Hmm.
And who thought it was appropriate for them to weigh in on this article? But Sir Arthur Conan Doyle himself.
Sherlock Holmes guy?
Sherlock Holmes guy and noted paranormal believer.
Right.
He said, quote, there are many malevolent spirits. And implied that it was possible that was the cause of Carnarvon's death.
I don't know. I mean, he was only a part of it. And did anyone else die?
Well, there are a few others that are attributed to the curse. Sir Bruce Ingham, who was a friend of archaeologist Howard Carter, our guy, our main character. This friend accepted the gift of a paperweight made from a mummified hand. Not Tut's hand. A mummified hand. And then his house burnt down.
Well, you know.
Serves you right. American financier George J. Gold visited the tomb. And then after that, I think within the same year, contracted pneumonia and died. And then they get more obscure from here. One person who was loosely associated with the tomb was in a car accident in 1970. And the London Times was like, it's the Pharaoh's curse.
It's like, no, we found it in the 20s.
No. Interestingly enough, a guy named Mark R. Nelson did a historical study of the Pharaoh's curse, which was published in the British Medical Journal. Dr. Nelson is an epidemiologist, and he researched the 44 Westerners who Carter said were at the tomb, and he narrowed that down to 25 who would have been quote-unquote exposed to the curse by epidemiologist standards.
Okay.
Which he says is by entering the tomb.
Okay.
Which I'll sign off on that. And he looked at Carter's diaries to identify these individuals. And then he went through and found all of their obituaries and like how they died and like when they died.
Okay.
And he found that it was like not a significant number of people who died. Quote, adjustment for age and sex, any exposure or the number of times exposed did not confer additional risk for early death.
Yeah, I mean, it could just be a coincidence like that. Unfortunately, it happens.
Another person looked into this actually and found that there were 58 people that were present in both the excavation and the like opening of the sarcophagus. And of those people, only 8 died within the next 12 years.
Well, and 12 years is a pretty long time.
Exactly. So, like, if we're trying to puzzle out, you know, who died of curse.
Wouldn't it be right away?
I would think so, or fairly quick. I think if we're past the 10-year mark, you cannot blame it on the curse.
Yeah, I think even the 1-year mark, I'm like, really?
No.
The ghost was biding their time for a year and then struck.
Hey, fucking Carter bided his time before he dug.
I guess, but you know, he almost lost it all.
He almost lost it all. But do you know who actually lived the longest out of all of the people present at the tomb?
Carter.
Carter lived to be like 64 or something, so he was fine. But the person who outlived him was Lady Evelyn Herbert, who was Carnarvon's daughter.
Sure.
And she lived to be 78, and she died in 1980.
Damn, yeah. So she beat the curse, I'd say.
Yeah, and the only woman present on the team.
Nice.
A win for ladies everywhere. So that is my deep dive on the finding of Tutankhamun's tomb, a brief look at his mummy, and a brief look at the curse.
And King Tut is applauding you with his little mummy hands from afar.
I hope so.
No, that was great, Soph.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for letting me go on so long. I really enjoyed this topic. I could talk about this topic for hours and hours. I think it's really fun to do every once in a while these big deep dives into stuff that truly like sparks that kind of like fervent interest, you know, where it's like, I cannot stop looking into this. I looked at Joe right before I did this and I was like, do you think 13 pages of research is too much? He was like, well, no turning back now, babe.
No, it was great.
I think the reason that I found this so interesting is like the possibilities of archaeology and like the hopes of archaeologists live in these type of things where like you have a hunch, you're putting together the clues and you unveil something your wildest dreams could not even fathom at the time. The promise of buried treasure, not just buried treasure, but like historically significant treasure. Like, can you imagine what it must have been like to walk in that room for the very first time?
To be the first person there in 3,000 years would be pretty amazing. And like, I really, again, we've said this, I hope that Dr. Martinez gets to have this moment with Cleopatra and shares it all with the rest of us who are dying to know what's going on.
Yeah. And like, there's such a, there feels like such a personalness to like both when that find happens, because it's gonna happen, and like this find, because one of the things that like was mentioned in one of the articles when it was talking about Carter looking at King Tut for the first time, his actual mummy, he was like, I know this person's, pretty much he said that like, this person's been dead for so long, but it still feels like awake to stand near him.
Yeah.
The gravity of this find, both in the archaeological world, but as like unveiling this corpse for the first time to tell its story.
Well, if you liked this story, you better get on over to your favorite podcast reviewing site, you know, Apple, Spotify, wherever, Amazon, ?
Yeah.
And give us a 5-star review. It really helps. And we hope that you have a great week and appreciate your bones. And as always, bone voyage.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Anything Bones. Follow us on Instagram or Facebook at Anything Bones Podcast, or email us at anythingbonespodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you to Nick Kruger for our spooky music, and Steven Vetteroff
at Chubby Scrubby on Twitter
for our jazzy vocals. And thank you to Camilla Franklin
at Camilla Strader on Instagram
for our beautiful bony artwork. Please rate, review, and subscribe.
We got into it. King Tut was a real dude. His tomb was very cool. I don't know. I've kind of lost the plot. I'm tired.